From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
My name is Asada Shakur, and I was born and raised in the United States. I am a descendant of Africans who were kidnapped and brought to the Americas as slaves.
Former Black Panther Asada Shakur, in exile in Cuba, issues an open letter to the Pope. It's the 25th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, and we look at the story of Jane, the legendary underground feminist abortion service. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. White House records show former intern Monica Lewinsky visited the Oval Office several times after her job there ended. Officials say she was visiting President Clinton's private secretary. Lewinsky has been allegedly caught on tape admitting to an affair with Clinton. Clinton is strongly denying allegations he had a sexual relationship with Lewinsky and asked her to lie about it. The matter is being investigated by Whitewater prosecutor Kenneth Starr, who plans to speak to reporters today in Washington. Newsweek magazine says Starr's office arranged a sting after former White House staffer Linda Tripp disclosed she had recorded conversations with Lewinsky discussing the alleged affair. Officials say job arrangements for Monica Lewinsky were made in the past few months as she was being pulled in as a witness in the Paula Jones suit against Clinton. In an affidavit, Lewinsky denies having an affair with Clinton. Cosmetic company Revlon, owned by the mogul Ron Perelman, disclosed that longtime Clinton friend Vernon Jordan referred Lewinsky for a public affairs job at a Revlon affiliate. Jordan is a member of the company's board. Revlon withdrew the offer yesterday. Officials also confirmed that UN Ambassador Bill Richardson interviewed Lewinsky for a junior public affairs job at the United Nations in New York. A spokesperson says Richardson wasn't pressured to hire her, but officials say White House Deputy Chief of Staff John Podesta acted on a request by Clinton's personal secretary to ask Richardson to consider Lewinsky. Sentences yesterday in a Columbus, Georgia federal courtroom for 22 protesters who trespass on the Fort Benning School of the Americas, calling on it to be closed down because of its record of training notorious Latin American officers, like those who killed the six Jesuit priests and their housekeeper and her daughter in El Salvador in the 1980s. The judge in the case is the oldest federal judge in the country. His name is J. Robert Elliott. He compared the School of the Americas protesters to bank robbers. He has a notorious record. He sentenced Martin Luther King to jail. He sprung Lieutenant Calley from jail. He led a walkout of the Democratic Convention in 1956 over a civil rights resolution and is known as a well-known segregationist. Roy Bourgeois, a father who has led the protests at School of the Americas, was one of those protesters who was sentenced to 6 months in jail and a $3,000 fine.
Prison is going to be hard. It's going to be lonely, as it always is. I've been there for over 3 years because of this judge. And I can only say we are going to speak from prison. Each of us, 22 of us, women and men from all walks of life, we're going to be in federal prisons scattered around this country. We have learned something very important. The truth cannot be silenced. We are going to speak from prison. And when we get out of prison, when we end these six-month sentences, we are coming back, and we will be back in greater numbers, and we are not going to shut up until that school of death, that school of horror, the school of the Americas, at Fort Benning, Georgia, is shut down.
Several of the protesters asked the judge to reduce the $3,000 fine. He said he would if they signed letters that said they would never return to the base. All refused. America Online says it should have never revealed the identity of a sailor who is now facing expulsion from the Navy for homosexuality. In a statement released before a court hearing today on the case, AOL says an employee broke company rules in telling a Navy investigator that Senior Chief Petty Officer Timothy McVeigh, no relation, was the author of a profile page describing himself as gay. The company adds that the caller from the Navy violated federal laws and established procedures for requesting information about AOL members because the investigator didn't say he was with the Navy. McVeigh is fighting the Navy's attempts to give him an honorable discharge. His lawyer adds they haven't ruled out a suit against AOL. President Clinton says the time for diplomacy might be dwindling in the confrontation with President Saddam Hussein over Iraq's refusal to open its suspected biological and chemical weapons sites to UN inspectors. Clinton suggested that the United States might be prepared to take military action against Iraq with or without the support of its allies or the Security Council. One hopes that motivation for this possible attack on the part of President Clinton is not to divert attention away from his own problems here at home. And this news from Santa Fe, New Mexico, demonstrators plan to show their support for free speech and Oprah Winfrey in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 25 years ago today, on January 22, 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court announced its decision in Roe v. Wade, a challenge to a Texas statute that made it a crime to perform an abortion unless a woman's life was at stake. The case had been filed by Jane Roe, an unmarried woman who wanted to safely and legally end her pregnancy. Siding with Roe, the court struck down the Texas law. In its ruling, the court recognized for the first time that the constitutional right to privacy, quote, is broad enough to encompass a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. Roe has come to be known as the case that legalized abortion nationwide. At the time the decision was handed down, nearly two-thirds of the states outlawed abortion except to save a woman's life. Roe rendered these laws unconstitutional, making abortion services safer and more accessible to women throughout the country. The decision also set a legal precedent that affected nearly 20 subsequent Supreme Court cases involving restrictions on access to abortion. We're joined right now by the president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, Gloria Feld. The Planned Parenthood Federation of America held a large press conference yesterday in Washington, D.C., to talk about the state of abortion today in the United States. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Glad to be here.
Well, good to have you. Why don't we talk a little about what it looks like today in 1998 for women who want to choose to have an abortion?
Well, Roe was the key and is the key still today to a whole set of freedoms about gender equality, planned and wanted children, women's health, and individual liberties to make reproductive decisions freely and privately. That is an ideal. The ideal has been chipped away considerably since it was decided by the Supreme Court 25 years ago. I think that this has impaired the ability of real women, and we're not talking hypotheticals here, we're talking about really impairing the ability of women to exercise their rights and protect their health, because the cases since the Roe decision have slowly but surely chipped away at Roe's protections in the legal sense. Equally importantly, I think that the social climate that's been created by 25 years of constant harassment, attacks, threats, and even violence on the part of anti-choice extremists is a social climate in which there is fear and in which doctors are afraid to practice, and so simple access is compromised as well.
We heard of a case actually just in the last week in Florida. It may have been in the Tampa area, where a doctor called the sheriff asking for support for protection because there were anti-choice protesters there. And he wrote back to the doctor that he would protect everyone on all sides of the issue, including him, the doctor, a man he called a baby killer. Is this something common we're seeing around the country? Where does law enforcement come down?
Well, it's absolutely outrageous, but unfortunately it does happen. I remember the first time I met with the chief of police in Phoenix when I was the CEO of the Planned Parenthood affiliate there, and the kinds of massive blockades were beginning to happen there. He said to me, well, just close your clinic when you know there's going to be a blockade. It has taken a great deal of education of law enforcement to get them to understand who the victim is here and who the perpetrators are here. It's not unusual, I'm sorry to say. The police and the law enforcement agencies of this country are not immune to their own personal beliefs, and it's incumbent upon those of us who provide reproductive health care, and I think also upon the citizens of the community and those who are in elected office, who have influence on law enforcement to make sure that they understand the importance of protecting a woman's ability to simply get the reproductive health care that she needs, and that requires having providers feel safe to go into those facilities.
I know that there were a number of people who were in Washington lobbying on the Hill, although Congress members are not back yet. What do you see as major legislation today that would protect women's right to choose? Is there such legislation?
Today, there is a tremendous need to take a very proactive and active position to regain the lost access. There's just no question about it. I would like to speak a little bit more about the law enforcement issue that we were talking about in the last topic, because this does relate to a piece of legislation that has been enormously helpful and that needs to be supported and reinforced, and that's the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, that at the federal level has made it a federal law to harass or threaten violence or commit violence against providers of reproductive health care. And that sort of bully pulpit of federal policy has enabled, has set a tone, I think, for local law enforcement that has pushed them to do a better job of protecting reproductive health care providers and the women who enter the facilities. So that's the kind of thing that needs to happen, and needs to happen at all levels of government. But I think we also need to move in two different areas, and Planned Parenthood specifically is launching, on the occasion of this 25th anniversary, a responsible choices state-by-state and federal agenda to do just that. We are looking to focus on both prevention of unintended pregnancy, which ultimately is the only way to reduce the need for abortion, and secondly, to restore lost access to abortion services for those who have lost that access, most notably the poor, the young, people who are geographically isolated. So we're looking to go on both of those tracks, and I think it's going to take a lot of effort. It's going to require that everybody who is pro-choice get involved in this effort. And I'm especially glad to have the opportunity to talk about this on a program called Democracy Now, because I think this hits at the very core of what democracy is all about. We've got to speak up and speak out if we're going to have choices in the future.
Well, Gloria Felt, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Gloria Felt, the president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Before she was president of the PPFA, she was head of the Planned Parenthood chapters in Arizona for more than two decades. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and if you want to read more about Planned Parenthood, you can go to their website at www.ppfa.org. That's www.ppfa.org. Well, in 1969, 4 years before Roe v. Wade decriminalized abortion, a group of women in Chicago responded to a critical problem, the danger and desperation faced by women who could not obtain legal abortions. The group set up an underground abortion referral service with a phone number and a single name, Jane. We're joined right now by two people who were part of that group. We're joined by Alice Fox and Laura Kaplan. Laura Kaplan was not only a member of Jane, but also author of a book on the subject called The Story of Jane, the Legendary Underground Feminist Abortion Service. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
Why don't we start with Laura? How did it all start?
Well, it started in a rather ad hoc, haphazard, I guess, kind of fashion. One woman who was a student activist at the University of Chicago got a call from a friend who was also a student about his sister who was desperate for an abortion. And as she tells the story, the student activist, she had no idea what to do about it, and she started asking around. And as she asked around and got the negative and horrified responses from the people she asked, she realized she had to do something. And she eventually did find a doctor, a black doctor who was active in the civil rights movement through her civil rights movement connections, who was regularly performing abortions. She was able to send that woman, and then subsequently got other calls from other women, and soon she became known as the contact person. And out of that, those small beginnings, she decided that she better organize a group in 1969 that would take on this work and build on it and make something out of it.
And so how did you get involved?
I got involved. I moved to Chicago in 1971, in the fall of 1971. And shortly after I moved to Chicago, my very dear friend Alice, who I'd gone to college with, found out that she was pregnant and looked for an illegal abortion. And I guess since Alice is here, she should tell that part of the story.
Well, Alice Fox, tell us your story.
At the time, I didn't know that I was pregnant for quite some time because I had an IUD and wasn't aware that I was pregnant. And once I finally had a positive test, I was freaked out about what to do and found under the underground newspaper there was a number that said, pregnant, need help, call Jane, which I did. And there were a series of phone calls that were leave your name, last menstrual period, some of that information. And I had no idea what I was getting into, but sort of followed the steps of the phone calls, some nice women on the phone. And when I finally met up with a counselor, she was a person like me. She wasn't a medical person. I met in her apartment with her two kids running around, and she described to me the procedure that I would go through. And again, I was just kind of following along, somehow trusting I was going to be okay, although this was very unconventional. I wasn't scared almost as soon as I met with this counselor, and then I was led along a path, which I then realized was the typical Jane path, which was that after meeting with the counselor and having the procedure explained to me, a date was set up for me to actually have the abortion. And I was taken in a car, and actually at that time we were blindfolded and driven around and taken to someone else's apartment. And even during the procedure, I was also at that time blindfolded. But there was a woman with me the whole time. There was someone holding my hand, talking to me, explaining everything. There were pamphlets and information and people and cookies and friends. And I felt during the entire abortion procedure, I was on a bed, not in an office. There was a counselor talking to me, holding my hand, giving me encouragement, telling me to breathe through the cramps. And by the time it was done, I have to tell you, Amy, I felt like I had been treated with such incredible loving care and respect that it really changed my life. And I was not only fine, I was really changed.
And this was what year?
I want to say 71. I think it was about 1970.
Yeah, it was fall of 71. I remember exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you wrote the book on the subject.
Well, and I also remember the event that triggered my life-changing involvement in Jane as well.
Now, you ended up, Laura Kaplan, not only helping Alice and getting involved with Jane, but founding a women's health clinic in Chicago.
Well, a group of us, after Jane folded, well, let me sort of backtrack a little bit and sort of bring us up to that point. Jane started out as a referral service, sending women to underground abortionists. Then the group evolved in that we got a very close relationship with one particular doctor. And we wound up setting up, and when Alice went through Jane, which is how we describe the process, it was during that time, the very end of that time, where we had this very close relationship with one doctor. We set up the work days. We worked out of apartments that belonged to us and to our friends. We did all the counseling. We were with women through the whole process. He demanded blindfolds. That was part of the agreement with him. But during that period of time, also women in the group were learning to perform the procedures themselves. And shortly after Alice's experience, the group was no longer used him at all. And it was all women. There were no blindfolds. It was a very different kind of feeling. But even so, with Alice's experience, you say, oh, an illegal abortion, and I was blindfolded, and still it had this life-changing quality. I remember when Alice came over to my apartment after her abortion, she was so excited by this illegal abortion experience that she was practically bouncing off the walls, and that's what motivated me. She took me to meet her counselor, and then I joined the group. So we folded when Roe v. Wade actually took effect in Chicago, which was the spring of 73, and organized this Women's Health Center.
Well, I want to ask you about the day that the Roe versus Wade decision came down 25 years ago today. But first, we have to take a break. We're talking to Alice Fox and Laura Kaplan, both Jane members. We're talking about the story of Jane, the legendary underground feminist abortion service. We'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On this 25th anniversary of the Supreme Court handing down its landmark decision, Roe versus Wade, which legalized abortion, we're joined by Laura Kaplan and Alice Fox. They are both Jane members. Jane, the legendary underground feminist abortion service. Alice Fox had a, I guess you'd call it an illegal abortion at that time.
Absolutely.
Now, in Chicago, in the state of Illinois, had there been a law decriminalizing abortion before Roe v. Wade?
No, there hadn't been.
So on January 22nd, 1973, that changed this country, really, for women. What were your reactions to the Supreme Court decision?
Well,
Laura Kaplan.
I guess I'll answer first. We at Jane were having regular working time during that week, and I believe during that day as well. That night, we had a celebration at one of the women in the group at her home, you know, with cheese and stuff to eat. And I remember there being two feelings going on in that room at the same time. One was a sense of utter relief and excitement. I mean, we had been risking our own freedom, risking other women's health, and because whenever you do an invasive procedure, you never know what you're going to run into. We'd been taking all kinds of risks with our own lives, with other women's lives, so it was an incredible relief to think that we could stop soon. We were, I think, getting pretty burned out. On the other hand, we had very mixed emotions. As we read the decision and looked at it, the Roe decision, if you read it, really frames the issue of abortion in two ways that we didn't agree with. One was that it frames it in terms of doctors' rights. It says explicitly this is a medical decision and ultimate authority for it belongs with the medical profession. And our feeling was from the very beginning, this is about women. This is about women's liberation. This is about women having the moral authority and control, which is part of that morality, to make decisions and to be an actor in the world. So we were very disappointed in that phase, and we were very also troubled by the framing it in terms of a right of privacy and not in a women's rights, a women's liberation perspective. And we had a feeling that the division into trimesters, which was a compromise, I think a compromise attempt to sort of placate all sides, would only bode ill for women in the future.
And just to clarify that point about privacy, which a lot of people may know already, but to reach its decision in Roe, the Supreme Court drew on decades of case law that established that the government cannot interfere with certain personal decisions about procreation, marriage, and other aspects of family life. And it went back to the Griswold versus Connecticut decision, a 1965 suit by the medical director of Planned Parenthood League of Connecticut. The Supreme Court found that a state statute making it a crime to use or provide birth control violated married couples' rights to privacy.
Right. That was just married couples. And it wasn't until, I believe, 72 in Eisenstadt versus Baird that right, the right to birth control was extended to single women as well. And I think we forget that. That wasn't all that long ago. And to think that before that, single women went through incredible changes, faking, you know, marriage, et cetera, to try to get contraceptives.
Now, you're talking about Roe versus Wade upholding doctors' rights. Jane did something very interesting, the whole group, and that is you went from supporting a doctor in doing these procedures to you, the women yourselves, doing the procedure. Can you explain?
Well, let me just say, because I think it was an important part of my experience with the group, that although I was one of, early enough in the group's history that the doctor did do my abortion, that part of what made the experience unique, I think, was this demystifying of the procedure, and that I think there is a lot of controversy about who is capable of doing medical procedures. But part of my experience, and I think what was so emotionally powerful about the experience, was the fact that there was something very regular about it, and something about women taking the control into their own hands for our own health and for each other, There was a sense of sisterhood that I think is a little bit hard to describe in this context, but it was a very powerful experience, and I think made it more than a medical procedure.
Well, what about the issue of doing the procedure yourselves?
I think, you know, it's hard to look at it from where we are today and not where we were then. I mean, this was a situation where, although we had a very close working relationship with this one man, who I have to say told us he was a doctor, we believed he was a doctor, and then at some point he admitted that, in fact, he wasn't a doctor. And that was really the moment at which that was revealed to the entire group, was that one of those aha moments. Well, if he can do it and he's not a doctor, then we can do it too, and we can charge a whole lot less. Because, you know, a lot of people were in the business who were very competent, and he was a very competent, caring person, but they were in it to make money. And we, of course, were not in it to make money. And we were in it to give women an opportunity to take control of their lives and to save their lives. And so it seemed a logical progression to us at that point. We'd been sitting in on abortions as a group. Members of the group had been sitting in for quite a while. And, you know, you watch and you watch and you watch and you say to yourself, this doesn't look so difficult. And you think, I could learn to do this. So I think there was that, it was an evolutionary process, and the way we trained women in the group was a very evolutionary, you know, apprentice kind of thing. You learn step by step, one piece of the process, and until you were comfortable with that, and then you moved on to the next piece of the process. But that, in fact, was incredibly radicalizing for both the women in the group and the women who came through Jane as well, that this was somebody like them in a T-shirt and jeans who had been sitting holding their hands a few minutes before and then got up and put on, you know, a headlamp and picked up instruments and explained everything. There was a sense of equalizing power between the practitioner and the person needing a service.
Well, in a sense, did things change? Actually, did you become disempowered after 1973 then, once it became legal and clearly went back into doctors' hands?
When you have the experience of empowerment in your life, you take it with you and you continue to build on it. Once you know that you can do in the world, that you can make a difference in the world, I think that's something, and Alice, you can corroborate that those of us who were in the group took with us. And some of the women who had abortions with Jane, when I interviewed them, said that that experience gave them permission in a way to then question medical authorities when other medical situations arose in their lives, to really demand to be treated well, to demand to have their questions answered.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Laura Kaplan and Alice Fox, two of the original Jane members, and Laura has written a book on the subject. It's called The Story of Jane, the Legendary Underground Feminist Abortion Service, and it's published by Pantheon Books. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Let's take a listen to Sandy Rapp singing Remember Rose, a song for choice.
I plan my own. I don't want to be in your theocracy. Remember liberty, remember Rose. Many more will go.
Many more will go.
By the way of Rose.
By the way of Rose.
And the ones that went.
The ones that went before her.
Unless a course is set.
Unless a course is set.
Present and direct.
Present and direct.
Because the chill wind blows and Rose is dead. Get your laws off me. I'm not your property. Don't plan my family. I'll plan my own. I don't want to be in your theocracy. Remember liberty, remember Rose. Get your laws off me.
And that is Remember Rose, a song for choice about the first casualty of the 1977 Medicaid abortion cutoff, with guest vocals by Bella Abzug. This from a CD of Sandy Rapp called We the People. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we head south. Greeted by President Fidel Castro of Cuba as he stepped off the plane, the Pope began his five-day trip to Cuba with an appeal for Cuba to open to the world and the world to open up to Cuba. Arriving on the Caribbean island yesterday, Pope John Paul II also took a slap at the U.S. economic embargo of the Caribbean nation. In his welcoming address, President Castro denounced the embargo as genocide. Speaking to reporters on the plane as he headed to Cuba, Pope John Paul said the embargo should be lifted. The Pope traveled to Santa Clara today for his first open-air mass. He'll be joined in a face-to-face meeting with Castro later today. We're joined now by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez, who is in Santa Clara. Welcome, Juan.
Thanks, Amy. Yes, the Pope arrived on schedule yesterday, and many people around the world did see Fidel Castro, the president, here greeting him, and both gave short speeches. But now the attention turns to the countryside of Cuba, and here in Santa Clara, where the Pope is scheduled in a few hours to celebrate his first Mass. This is the poorest province in Cuba, and it's also one that had some degree in the past of active Catholic observance. One of the things that I think most people don't realize is that Cuba has never had a very strong Catholic Church, unlike the Catholic Church in Poland. There's always been a minority of people, even before the revolution, who considered themselves practicing Catholics, and as such, the Church never had quite the strength that it did in Poland when Poland was a socialist country. So that the resurgence of the Catholic Church in recent years has been quite phenomenal. All the churches here in Santa Clara, there are four major ones in the city and several in the outlying areas, are regularly packed with the Catholic faithful who are attending masses. Some of the churches have several masses on Sunday, so they're bringing out people in force. The government is not closing the public schools except in the city of Santa Clara, but is urging teachers to allow any students who are Catholic and want to participate to go to the Mass, as well as is providing free transportation for anyone in the throughout the province who wants to attend the Mass. There's an expectation of easily 100, maybe 200,000 people are going to be at the Mass this morning. I think the critical issue, of course, in terms of the United States, is to what degree the Pontiff's message, which in this Mass will be centered around the family and the importance of the family in Cuban life. Every Mass has a theme. The Mass in Camagüey will be around the issue of youth, but here will be around the family, and it is expected to draw not only tremendous outpouring of support, but also there may be some contentious areas between the party faithful and the supporters of the revolution, who will be enlarged, who will be out in large numbers as well. So this is the first test, the test of how well this new cooperation between the Catholic Church and the Cuban government will work itself out.
And Juan, as you were telling us yesterday on Democracy Now!, Santa Clara is the place where Che Guevara's bones were finally laid to rest after they were dug up in Bolivia.
Right, there's a mausoleum just on the in a beautiful plaza just on the outskirts of town, which is normally the place where all major gatherings are held. But as I explained yesterday, at the request of Catholic hierarchy, this particular Mass was switched to an area in a soccer field. And I spoke to some of the Canadian sound people who have been brought in to do the sound systems at all of the Masses, and they're having all kinds of problems because obviously a whole new platform and electricity and power lines. There was a lot of work that had to be done to change this soccer field into an appropriate area, and they were as of late last night, they still had not completed the sound system, and they were getting a little worried as to whether it would be ready, but it looks like it very well may be. And I think also, but in talking to many of the people here, the U.S. Press has been focusing largely on the issue of whether there's going to be change in Cuba in the direction of human rights. My sense is in dozens of interviews with everyday Cubans, the main issue they're concerned about is not so much the spiritual betterment of the situation in Cuba as the material betterment. Cuba is really one of the richest poor countries in the world, in the sense that although salaries are abysmally low in relationship to the U.S. dollar, the Cuban people on the whole get so much for those abysmally low salaries in terms of subsidized housing, free health care, child care, and free public education, that their main concern right now continues to be the difficulty in getting sufficient food into the country, the high cost of clothing, which is a terrible problem. A good pair of pants that might cost here $12 or $15 is the equivalent of almost a month's salary for some people. So a tank of gasoline, a full tank of gasoline in the car costs you $40, which is the equivalent of 2 months' salary for a doctor in the country. So that the scarcity of gasoline that's driven up the price, food, and clothing are the real concerns that that just have people barely surviving, but barely so, and feeling tremendously under the gun. So their hope is that the Pope's visit will somehow produce better relations between the United States and Cuba. I talked to a couple of men who live right next door to the soccer field, adjacent to the soccer field in the Sandino housing development there, and they recall back to the time of the dictator Machado, way long before Batista, and they remarked about how life in Cuba has improved substantially, but that their words were, after 40 years, this battle with the United States has gone long enough, and everyone wants to have some kind of reconciliation with the U.S. government, and hopefully the Pope's visit will have some impact on that.
Finally, Juan, we mentioned that Pope John Paul II, while flying to Cuba today, said to reporters that he was calling for an easing of the many decade-old embargo against Cuba by the United States. But what about Cuban President Fidel Castro? What has he had to say with the landing of the Pope?
Well, of course, Fidel gave a long presentation a few nights ago, a six-hour speech to the nation, where he exhorted the nation to welcome the Pope in a true Cuban style of hospitality. Unfortunately, I think his speech did not go over very well with the large foreign press delegation, mostly because he called it a press conference and had four Cuban journalists who basically asked a couple of questions here and there in between his long answers. And I think for those who see the press in Cuba as muzzled, as unable to really openly raise important and controversial questions, this only reinforced that. And I mentioned myself to some of the Cuban officials whom I spoke to that if Fidel had wanted to give a six-hour speech, he should have gone ahead and done it, and not called it a press conference. So I think that definitely hurt some of the excellent public relations that the Cuban government has been involved in. But interestingly enough, Foreign Minister Roberto Robaina came by the International Press Center a couple of days ago and made an interesting remark to all the foreign journalists assembled. He said, "You know, report anything you want when you're in Cuba these days. Say what you have to say, but just remember, we're not quite as bad as some would paint us, nor are we quite as good as we would like to be."
Well, Juan, I want to thank you very much for that report. Juan Gonzalez, Democracy Now! Co-host, reporting from Santa Clara, where the Pope is holding his first open-air mass in Cuba this morning. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, an open letter from a U.S. exile in Cuba, Asada Shakur. Stay with us. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now to an open letter that was written to the Pope on Martin Luther King's birthday by Asada Shakur. Asada Shakur, who was with the Black Liberation Army, a former Black Panther. She's an exile in Cuba. In the United States, she was convicted and sentenced to life in prison for the 1973 murder of a New Jersey state trooper. It's a crime she says she did not commit. She was able to escape from prison. She went to Cuba, and she has written this letter to the Pope.
Your Holiness, I hope this letter finds you in good health, in good disposition, and enveloped with the spirit of goodness. I must confess that it had never occurred to me before to write you, and I find myself overwhelmed and moved to have this opportunity. Although circumstances have compelled me to reach out to you, I am glad to have this occasion to try and cross the boundaries that would otherwise tend to separate us. I understand that the New Jersey State Police have written to you and asked you to intervene and to help facilitate my extradition back to the United States. I believe that their request is unprecedented in history. Since they have refused to make their letter to you public, although they have not hesitated to publicize their request, I am completely uninformed as to the accusations they are making against me. Why, I wonder, do I warrant such attention? What do I represent that is such a threat? Please let me take a moment to tell you about myself. My name is Asada Shakur, and I was born and raised in the United States. I am a descendant of Africans who were kidnapped and brought to the Americas as slaves. I spent my early childhood in the racist, segregated South. I later moved to the northern part of the country, where I've realized that Black people were equally victimized by racism and oppression. I grew up and became a political activist, participating in student struggles, the anti-war movement, and most of all, in the movement for the liberation of African Americans in the United States. I later joined the Black Panther Party, an organization that was targeted by the COINTELPRO program, a program that was set up by the Federal Bureau of Investigation to eliminate all political opposition to the U.S. government's policies, to destroy the Black liberation movement in the United States, to discredit activists, and to eliminate potential leaders. Under the COINTELPRO program, many political activists were harassed, imprisoned, murdered, or otherwise neutralized. As a result of being targeted by COINTELPRO, I, like many other young people, was faced with the threat of prison, underground, exile, or death. The FBI, with the help of local police agencies, systematically fed false accusations and fake news articles to the press, accusing me and other activists of crimes we did not commit. Although in my case the charges were eventually dropped or I was eventually acquitted, the national and local police agencies created a situation where, based on their false accusations against me, any police officer could shoot me on sight. It was not until the Freedom of Information Act was passed in the mid-70s that we began to see the scope of the United States government's persecution of political activists. At this point, I think that it is important to make one thing very clear. I have advocated, and I still advocate, revolutionary changes in the structure and in the principles that govern the United States. I advocate self-determination for my people and for all oppressed people inside the United States. I advocate an end to capitalist exploitation, the abolition of racist policies, the eradication of sexism, and the elimination of political repression. If that is a crime, then I am totally guilty. To make a long story short, I was captured in New Jersey in 1973 after being shot with both arms held in the air and then shot again from the back. I was left on the ground to die, and when I did not, I was taken to a local hospital where I was threatened, beaten, and tortured. In 1977, I was convicted in a trial that can only be described as a legal lynching. In 1979, I was able to escape with the aid of some of my fellow comrades. I saw this as a necessary step, not only because I was innocent of the charges against me, but because I knew that the racist legal system in the United States, I would receive no justice. I was also afraid that I would be murdered in prison. I later arrived in Cuba, where I am currently living in exile as a political refugee. The New Jersey State Police and other law enforcement officials say they want to see me brought to justice. But I would like to know what they mean by justice. Is torture justice? I was kept in solitary confinement for more than 2 years, mostly in men's prisons. Is that justice? My lawyers were threatened with imprisonment and imprisoned. Is that justice? I was tried by an all-white jury without even the pretext of impartiality and then sentenced to life in prison plus 33 years. Is that justice? Let me emphasize that justice for me is not the issue I am addressing here. It is justice for my people that is at stake. When my people receive justice, I am sure that I will receive it too. I know that Your Holiness will reach your own conclusions, but I feel compelled to present the circumstances surrounding the application of so-called justice in New Jersey. I am not the first or the last person to be victimized by the New Jersey system of justice. The New Jersey State Police are infamous for their racism and brutality. Many legal actions have been filed against them. And just recently, in a class action legal proceeding, the New Jersey State Police were found guilty of having an, quote, officially sanctioned de facto policy of targeting minorities for investigation and arrest, unquote. Although New Jersey's population is more than 78% white, more than 75% of the prison population is made up of blacks and Latinos. 80% of women in New Jersey prisons are women of color. There are 15 people on death row in the state, and 7 of them are black. A 1987 study found that New Jersey prosecutors sought the death penalty in 50% of cases involving a black defendant and a white victim, but only 28% of cases involving a black defendant and a black victim. Unfortunately, the situation in New Jersey is not unique, but reflects the racism that permeates the entire country. The United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. There are more than 1.7 million people in U.S. prisons. This number does not include the more than 500,000 people in city and county jails, nor does it include the alarming number of children in juvenile institutions. The vast majority of those behind bars are people of color, and virtually all of those behind bars are poor. The result of this reality is devastating. 1/3 of black men between the ages of 20 and 29 are either in prison or under the jurisdiction of the criminal justice system. Prisons are big business in the United States, and the building, running, and supplying of prisons has become the fastest growing industry in the country. Factories are moving into the prisons, and prisoners are forced to work for slave wages. This super exploitation of human beings has meant the institutionalization of a new form of slavery. Those who cannot find work on the streets are forced to work in prison. Not only are the prisons used as instruments of economic exploitation, they also serve as instruments of political repression. There are more than 100 political prisoners in the United States. They are African Americans, Puerto Ricans, Chicanos, Native Americans, Asians, and progressive white people who oppose the policies of the United States government. Many of those targeted by the COINTELPRO program have been in prison since the early 1970s. Although the situation in prisons is an indication of human rights violations inside the United States, there are other, more deadly indicators. There are currently 3,365 people now on death row, and more than 50% of those awaiting death are people of color. Black people make up only 13% of the population, but we make up 41.01% of persons who have received the death penalty. The number of state assassinations has increased drastically. In 1997 alone, 71 people were executed. A special rapporteur appointed by the United Nations organization found serious human rights violations in the United States, especially related to the death penalty. According to his findings, people who are mentally ill were sentenced to death. People with severe mental and learning disabilities, as well as minors under 18. Serious racial bias was found on the part of judges and prosecutors. Specifically mentioned in the report was the case of Mamia Abu-Jamal, the only political prisoner on death row, who was sentenced to death because of his political beliefs and because of his work as a journalist exposing police brutality in the city of Philadelphia. I believe that some people spell God with one O, while others spell it with two. What we call God is unimportant as long as we do God's work. There are those who want to see God's wrath fall on the oppressed and not on the oppressors. I believe that the time has ended when slavery, colonialism, and oppression can be carried out in the name of religion. It was in the dungeons of prison that I felt the presence of God up close, and it has been my belief in God and in the goodness of human beings that has helped me to survive. I am not ashamed of having been in prison, and I am certainly not ashamed of having been a political prisoner. I believe that Jesus was a political prisoner who was executed because he fought against the evils of the Roman Empire, because he fought against the greed of the money changers in the temple, because he fought against the sins and injustices of his time. As a true child of God, Jesus spoke up for the poor, for the meek, for the sick and the oppressed. The early Christians were thrown into lion's dens. I will try to follow the example of so many who have stood up in the face of overwhelming oppression. I am not writing to ask you to intercede on my behalf. I ask nothing for myself. I only ask you to examine the social reality of the United States and to speak out against the human rights violations that are taking place. On this day, the birthday of Martin Luther King, I am reminded of all those who gave their lives for freedom. Most of the people who live on this planet are still not free. I ask only that you continue to work and pray to end oppression and political repression. It is my heartfelt belief that all the people on this earth deserve justice, social justice, political justice, and economic justice. I believe it is the only way we will ever achieve peace and prosperity on this earth. I hope that you enjoy your visit to Cuba. This is not a country that is rich in material wealth, but it is a country that is rich in human wealth, spiritual wealth, and moral wealth. Respectfully yours, Asada Shakur, Havana, Cuba.
And if you'd like to hear that letter to the Pope again or hear any of our Cuba programming, you can go to our website, www.pacifica.org, and click on Cuba Conversations to hear our entire Cuba series, as well as link to organizations working on the issue. Thank you, Michelle Garcia. Democracy Now! Produced by Hee-Soo Koo, Errol Maitland, our engineer, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. Tune in tomorrow when we take a look at the life of Che Guevara. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!